William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, where history proves that truth, or at least their version of it, is truly stranger than fiction. Today I'm diving into the discussion about the minor prophets. And no, I know what you're thinking, not those minor prophets, not the biblical ones. But I want to talk about the minor prophets that nobody really thinks about, that are really behind the creation of the New Apostolic Reformation. We all know the big names. If you look at the NAR today, you've got the Mike Bickles, the Bill Johnsons. Go back in history, in the healing revivals, you've got the Branhams, the A.A. Allens. But what about all of those little people, the people who were prophets in the fivefold ministry, but not the ones who created their own spin-off movements, which some of which turned into destructive cults? It is actually one of the most important questions that nobody asks. Why are these little people forgotten? And what was their significance? Because you don't hear their names. In the Old Testament, you had the major prophets and the minor prophets. And I know that the healing revivals and large portions of Pentecostalism kind of spin this in the incorrect direction. A major prophet is somebody who is great importance, and a minor prophet was a lesser important prophet in that viewpoint. But in the Bible context, in the context of the canon, a major prophet means that this is a person who was a prophet of the Old Testament, and we have a large number of his prophecies. And then the minor prophets, we don't have very much. It doesn't mean that there's a ranking system of prophets. But in the Latter Rain movement, post-World War II healing revival, New Apostolic Reformation, there is a ranking system. There are major prophets and there are minor prophets. The major prophets are remembered. The minor prophets are forgotten. That's really important to understand, because if you understand why that is, then you understand just how deceptive the whole thing is. And I came across this thought a long, long time ago. As I'm digging through these histories and I'm learning what I came out of Branhamism, and I'm trying to understand, well, how did this come to be? And I started realizing that there were names that I heard that nobody else had heard. Because in our group, we listened to the recordings of William Branham from 1947 to 1965 over and over and over. I would hear it from the beginning of my life until the day that I left. We were listening to these recordings. So we were stuck in an era that is long forgotten. And many of these names that most of the world has no clue even existed, we heard because some of them were minor prophets. They were prophets who were long forgotten and they weren't of great importance in the movement. What does this mean from a biblical standpoint? In the Bible, there was no ranking system. There was no hierarchy. And the prophecies themselves were all significant. It didn't matter if it was one of the minor prophets or a major prophet, because in the biblical system, the prophet is not the one doing the speaking. It is God using the human as a mouthpiece, and the mouthpiece speaks directly what God is saying. That's why there cannot be a single detail that is off. Otherwise, it didn't come from God. Because if you believe in an omnipotent, all-knowing God, you can't miss details. That's not the same way with the Pentecostal prophets, the Latter Rain prophets, the New Apostolic Reformation prophets, charismatic prophets. In that succession, you can miss details as long as you get something right. If you get one detail right, God must have given you that detail, and God was wrong about all those other details. And so we'll change our history to match the big detail that we got right, and let's just forget about the problems with this prophecy. That's kind of how this worked. And so in this revision process, the major prophets, the one who we remember today, are remembered for their quote-unquote accurate prophecies that have been revised over time. And the minor prophets, those whose prophecies are not revised, they remain stagnant. They're not updated, they're not refreshed, they're not cleaned for accuracy, they're not removed. Whenever the prophecy fails, they don't remove it from a prophetic history. So these guys just kind of get forgotten. But yet they are one of the most important factors. Think about IHOP KC. IHOP KC, the face of the movement is Mike Bickle, International House of Prayer in Kansas City is the acronym if people aren't familiar. He is the face of that movement, and he is a large reason why the New Apostolic Reformation came to be. It was through all these networks of connecting people and faces, and it's a history we cover if you want to learn more. But think about that. He is the major prophet. Then you have the Kansas City Prophets, Kansas City Fellowship. People often ask me, why that? Why do we need, like Bob Jones, people who knew him, people who saw his prophecies, saw his appearance, the way that he acted, they're like scratching their head. Why do we need this guy? Mike Bickle is the face of the movement. Why in that succession was he so important? We have to understand he is one of the minor prophets. He did not start his own movement. There are huge flaws with many aspects of him. I won't go into this podcast. People are aware of those because his histories are not being revised and rewritten. In fact, some of them are being erased. If you talk to some of the people who are in the know in IHOP KC who have escaped, they'll tell you that these prophetic histories continue to be revised. And why is this, John? Well, it comes back to the fact that there are major prophets in the movement, minor prophets. Now, in the Latter Rain movement, the interesting part of all of this, now that we start to see the fruits of the ministry, we start to see people who are prophets or apostles in the movement who have deep, deep theological, personal, sometimes criminal flaws. People who see this, they see the climax of what happened. They don't see the steps in between. And so they start investigating. Where did this come from? And they'll hear a phrase like, share an orphanage, for example. So you look at share an orphanage, who was in that network? You have George Houghton, Ern Houghton, Percy Hunt, Herrick Holt. You've got this group of men who started the share an orphanage. They weren't necessarily prophets per se, although one of them may have had a prophecy, but this was a tier that was backing the overall movement. So in the ranking system, if you think of it like a pyramid, at the top you've got the people who are the faces of the movement, then directly under this are the people who are supporting those faces. Let me explain this in a different way. Let's say that I decide I want to be famous, and I book a convention center downtown. I go downtown, I invite everybody, advertise, marketing, etc., and start preaching. I get people in the audience to get really emotional, excited, do all of the things that charismatics do. And then suddenly at the end of it, after I have toyed with their emotions and manipulated them to be open boxes that I can fill, I start to say, I had a prophecy. And you must change every single aspect of your life because my prophecy is true. Who's going to do it, right? Who's going to believe this? They would say, John, you're nuts. And many people would walk out of here, right? So it isn't just that a person can claim it. That makes them a self-proclaimed prophet. And if that were the case, every single prophet that we see in Charismania, New Apostolic Reformation, they would all be branded self-proclaimed prophets, not apostles and prophets with prophetic insight in a prophetic movement. That's not how it works. Now, in that same event, say that I brought five people with me, and the five people are on stage, I tell my prophecy, everybody's scratching their heads thinking, I don't really want to change my life and walk away from families and all of the many weird things that they ask you to do. But then suddenly one of those five stands up and says, I'm a prophet too, and I had a prophecy very similar to what he just said. Let me tell you what it is. And then they start to say something that is so generic, so, I don't know, mystic, so symbolic that matches what I said in some form, maybe not as accurate, but just enough to make the person think about their prophecy. It may not be detailed, it may not even have any substance, But maybe there's that one element that sounds, yeah, that could sound like John's prophecy. I wonder if it is. And the people start scratching their heads thinking, well, maybe it is. And then the next person does it. Then the next person. Before that meeting is over, there will be a percentage, not all, but there will be a large percentage of people in there that at least have the question planted, I wonder if John really is a prophet. He says he is. Those other people, their prophecies sound like it. I wonder. And so they go home, they start looking into it, and they think about it. They read the Bible. They start to see identifying markers of things that I said in my prophecy purposefully that matched some scripture that they read. And a subset of those people will suddenly say, oh my gosh, John is a prophet. Let's abandon everything and join. And as weird as that sounds, that really is how this played out. You have so many people in the movement doing this. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be a prophecy. There are examples, we've talked about it in the Revival History series. There are people who aren't even recognized as a minor prophet who had a supportive dream. And the dreams, if you go back and into the examples that we gave, they're supporting prophecies that did not come to pass. So you have to ask the question first, was it a dream from God? Because if the prophecy didn't come to pass and the supportive dream was about that prophecy, well, I don't think that was from God. But the next question really becomes, did that person really have that dream, or were they just trying to support and encourage the crowd to believe the prophet? I have come to the conclusion, and it is my opinion, that you have both. You have people who truly have something happen, whether it's of God or not, and they believe what happened to them, whether it's a vision, a prophecy, a dream, etc. Those people in that category, they're not trying to deceive people. They just had something happen, and they don't really have the tools to determine, was that from God or was that just something that happened? On the other hand, we clearly have shown examples where people purposefully said things that weren't true of the spiritual nature to back or support something that the movement presented. And for me, when you combine those two categories, it really doesn't matter if one side is truly believing what they said and the other side is not. The end result is the same. The people will believe the stage act that is supposed to eventually become the major prophet. So this turns into this weird mess that you go through the names, and I mentioned Percy Hunt, Holt, etc. Because people are researching this, those names are familiar. Until they did, they were long forgotten. Nobody heard the name George Warnock until now we start to investigate the manifested sons of God. Who is this guy? And they don't even realize that many of Warnock's ideas came from Branham and Branhamism as it was developing. So the true history is kind of lost. People like Myrtle Beale. That is a name in Lateran. If you're in a Lateran circle, you know this name because she is one of the supportive prophets. In fact, I think she rose up to become, you'd call her a major preacher in the Lateran movement, I guess. Well, she had a prophetic voice that some of the details many people have forgotten. She was apparently the one who laid hands on Jim Jones of Jonestown and said, God has given me the spirit of anointing to anoint you as this new leader of the movement. And he was joining into the Branham movement. We have evidence supporting this on the website. She laid hands on him, and look what happened with Jonestown. You had so many people that died with this. Was that an anointing by God? No. But this is another person supporting the claim that Jones is vindicated as a true messenger or true minister in the fivefold ministry of latter rain. We have a person named Anna Schrader, who Chino and I have mentioned a few times, was the equivalent of Myrtle Beale with regards to Hobart Freeman. She was working directly with Christ for the Nation's founder, Gordon Lindsay, and others in the Voice of Healing movement, and she apparently told Hobart Freeman that he was anointed as this new minister right after William Branham died, which gets really odd when you think about it. Here we have Branham going off the scene, who is the leader of the movement. Now we have to find a new leader. Suddenly Hobart Freeman's elected, and the rest is history. His cult, there are a lot of people who died as well in his cult, but not many people know the name Anna Schrader. I know it because Schrader was one of the ones who apparently or allegedly prophesied that William Branham would die after most of the movement had revolted. There was this period of time in history when many of the minor prophets and some of the major prophets all condemned Branham for his serpent seed doctrine, which was very racist and anti-Semitic. They rose up against him and they began to prophesy, this guy is out. And again, you have to question, was that really from God or did they just want to save face whenever it was recognized that this was a racist that was backed by some of the more racist and more sinister parts of American history. But Anna Schrader is a name that most of you are not familiar with until we start bringing it up. But the problem is she was apparently a prophetess in the movement. So what does it mean to be a prophetess or a minor prophet in the movement? And I'm pulling up a prophecy that later was titled Jezebel and Ahab Must Be Dethroned. And you can find this, if you go online, you can find some of Anna Schrader's prophecies that were preserved. The problem for me is that a large number of them were not preserved. And why is that? For a movement that is teaching that these are Old Testament-style prophets, and the prophecies are given directly by God to the church to prepare them for the last days, would not you think that those prophecies to prepare you would be important? And apparently they're not by these minor prophets. So in this prophecy, Jezebel and Ahab must be dethroned. There are a few key things that you must understand about how all of this works. Number one, these prophecies are very, very vague. In the Bible, whenever it was prophesied about Jezebel and Ahab, it was literally about Jezebel and Ahab. So whenever they're talking about Jezebel and Ahab in this context, they're actually referring to a sitting president and his wife. However, by using the term Jezebel, the name Ahab, now you have made this prophecy vague enough that you can resurrect it and you can apply it to any prophet or any president that is sitting in office. All you have to do is say, we're against this president, and we rise up against the Jezebel and Ahab that's sitting in office, right? In the years of JFK, which were very short, I should say months of JFK, he was the Ahab and Jacqueline Kennedy was the Jezebel by all of these people. William Branham had sermons about how he needed to go dethrone Jezebel and Ahab. So we don't have a date for when this prophecy from Anna Schrader was. However, there are enough voices that are speaking against Kennedy during that era that most likely this was a prophecy given about President Kennedy, which is probably why they don't talk about this prophecy very much. But as you can see, and I've got it up on the screen if you're watching the YouTube version of this, they're using biblical symbolism on purpose to target individuals in politics and try to make the connection in the people's minds between the evil characters of the Bible and people who are actually in office in an elected official position. This, for me, is another big problem of the movement. Number one, if it was by God, would not you think that God would just name the individuals that we're targeting? And that's not what happened here. Number two, Schrader said, you must meet them face to face and tell them, as Elijah told them, that God had answered by fire, he was God. Now, in the face of this movement, the foremost leader of the post-World War II healing revival was William Branham. And there were many, many people in the movement that believed that he was the return of the biblical Elijah. And Branham had prophecies about quote-unquote Jezebel and Ahab in office. So you had Branham who's saying this. He is the major prophet of the movement. You had the minor prophets that were supporting them with things like this. And you can see how all of this would play out into the minds of the people. Suddenly, everybody is revolting against JFK and Jacqueline Kennedy because we have now multiple voices who are targeting them, saying that these are the people who God has appointed us to attack in our day. So how did all of this begin? That is really the most important question here. Understanding how the movement began to deviate from the biblical definitions of apostles, prophets, evangelists, and teachers, and then began to separate into hierarchies of what we consider a major prophet of the movement and a minor prophet of the movement, creating these structures that aren't biblical, don't really exist in the Bible, and then began to proclaim that they are Old Testament-style prophets. When you understand that history, how it evolved, you begin to understand how people who were so-called major prophets in the movement could be given such authority and control over the people that phrases like "touch not God's anointed" would apply to people who really didn't have any anointing at all. That is a history that to really understand, you have to go back to Branham. Branham was at one point in time recognized in the newspapers, or I should say advertised in the newspapers, as America's voice of healing. And he began touring under that platform, that name. And for one reason or another, he got more famous than some of the other healers. And there were many that existed in that era. He began to become a little bit more famous, and eventually his advertisement turned into him writing a column in a PCI newsletter, PCI standing for Pentecostal Church Incorporated, and that column in that newsletter eventually was replaced by the Voice of Healing publication, and it was advertised as an inter-evangelical. In other words, there are many evangelists out there, many healers out there, an inter-evangelical publication of the Branham Healing Campaigns. So this initially began with him as the face of the movement. And what happened over time is that those inter-evangelicals, the other evangelists in the movement, began to have faces. But from its inception, Branham was supposed to be the face of the movement, and the others were supposed to be the lesser figures. Or if you consider the fact that he was claiming to be prophet, he would be the prophet, and everyone else would have been a quote-unquote minor prophet in the movement. That was the initial structure. But it didn't take long before I think both he and I know Gordon Lindsay recognized that there's a lot of power in creating more than just one main figure. We need major figures in the movement, and yes, we still must have the minor figures, because I explained earlier how all of that worked. So within just a brief period of time, this inter-evangelical campaign that was publishing William Branham's ministry suddenly morphed into, now we're publishing many major figures. And the initial group was smaller, you know, there might have been 15, 20 different people. But if you read through the magazine, they're giving names and faces of others in the movement who are supporting the idea that we're involved in this healing revival. So essentially what happened is Branham comes out saying that we are in a healing revival. God has come down in our midst. We have the prophets, the angels, all of the many things that were part of the stage show. And we have others doing similar stage shows. Therefore, is not God in our presence? Just like I said before, I could come out and I could say, God has given me a prophecy. Do you believe me? Well, I don't know if you do or not. But if I have people supporting me, now I've got a better chance of you believing me. Well, Branham and Lindsay were trying to make the argument, we have this move of God that is coming in the form of revival. It is a healing revival. We have a face. We have a man who's claiming it. Well, now we have these supportive figures who are also echoing what he is saying. So to summarize, in this type of environment, these big prophetic movements are never built by one major prophet. In other words, there isn't a single person who God is speaking through, and God is in control of not only the speaker, the prophet, but also the people to be receptive to this person. This type of strategy requires a second tier above that top tier. It's a second tier of prophetesses, conference speakers, writers, interpreters, endorsers, advertising, networks. There's an entire business element to this that is required for a major prophet to become that status in the movement. And if you don't have that structure, this never could have worked. So there was a business organization behind it, and it was churning out these ministries, and to the detriment of Christianity in America, Canada, and abroad. Some of those ministries that were endorsed weren't very good ones, but yet they were required as that second tier so that we could have the top tier. And those top tiers became big names in the movement. Like I said, Branham, A.A. Allen, Oral Roberts. You had many different ministries which evolved into many different directions, such as the Prosperity God Gospel movement, the Word of Faith movement, etc. All of those people came back to the central hub, the central business organization, and it was the central hub that created the ability to network all of this. When C. Peter Wagner coined the term New Apostolic Reformation, he admitted that he wasn't inventing something new. He was describing something that pre-existed. And he went into details, and he told people about the middle tier. We have all of these networks, all of these people, conferences working together in that middle tier. And in that middle tier, we're all a cohesive unit. I therefore declare this to be the New Apostolic Reformation. What was kind of missing from that, and I think forgotten to history, is the fact that that middle tier was built for a very specific purpose, to elevate these ministries of the major prophets, and that second tier was just describing an entire labyrinth of networks that were part of this healing revival movement, as well as other movements beyond the healing revival. So, in essence, everybody knows the major names, but these movements were not built by these individuals. It was that second tier that's most important to understand why their ministries began and how they could flourish. If you recognize the historical significance of this, you begin to ask the question, well, is that tier needed in a biblical ministry? If God is the one who's all-powerful and in control of everything, does God really need a business entity to make it work?
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
I've mentioned this on a few of the podcasts, but there is a little-known figure named Lee Vail, who was very important to the establishment of what became Branhamism and eventually became the New Apostolic Reformation. Lee Vail is considered by some to be William Branham's publicist. But he wasn't just that. He was one of these reaffirming figures that I'm referring to. And again, some of the reaffirming figures were not just simply prophets or prophetesses. You had the fivefold ministry structure, which enabled, in this type of environment, the notion that a preacher who is not a prophet can speak under the anointing, and therefore, by sheer definition of biblical prophecy, that is a prophet, which is why some of them claim that anything that they say might be a prophecy, which it gets really weird when you think of all of the implications of this. But all of that aside, Lee Vail is a name that many people just do not know. In the charismatic movement, he's unheard of. Latter Rain, he is long forgotten. But he was one of the figures who was supporting William Branham's themes that Branham would introduce. There was a letter that was withheld from the public until after Branham's death. Branham would send these audio letters, kind of like we would on our iPhones today when we send an audio text message. Branham would hit record and then record a reel-to-reel or whatever it was, send it to Lee Vail, and here's my note. And that's how he would do it. Well, we
have an audio letter where William Branham is telling Lee Vale, I'm going to go say this thing, whatever it is. I want you to back it up, but I want you to begin laying the foundation for this. One of the things that we've mentioned and we detected, Branham came up with this weird, weird idea to separate his ministry from Billy Graham's ministry. He decided that he could use the biblical name Abraham and put emphasis on the Ham part of Abraham because his name, Branham, had the same last three letters. And the difference between his last name and Graham or Graham, Billy Graham had six letters in his last name, while William Branham had seven in his last name. Abraham has seven letters in it, so therefore Branham must be more biblical, more righteous than Billy Graham. It's a weird, weird thing that people today, if they knew that this was part of the latter rain strategy, they would just shake their head. What were these people thinking? People who have actually seen the ancient Hebrew, they're aware that the word, the letters used for Abraham, it's only four letters in the Hebrew. So the argument of seven letters does not make any sense at all. But that was the argument. Branham ran with it. He told Lee Vale, now I'm going to spell out my name, A-B-B-R-A-H-A-M, and it would be really good for you, Dr. Vale. Dr. Vale was a nickname. He wasn't actually a doctor of divinity. It'd be really good for you, Dr. Vale, if you would emphasize the fact that I have seven letters in my last name and Abraham had seven letters in his. What's interesting about this is, this, fast forward to 19, when did I start beginning to, I began to start to understand Branhamism in the 80s. So 1980-ish, we're still thinking about the seven letters and the name of William Branham, who has been dead since 1965. So for us, this was an important prophecy, or I guess you would say anointed speaking. It wasn't really a prophecy. Fast forward to 2012 when we left. It wasn't until 2012 that I began to realize this isn't important at all and has no relationship whatsoever to my walk with Jesus Christ when I began to leave this movement and start to enter Christian churches. Christian churches could care less if their pastor had seven names in the last name of his given name. So why this? Why would you have something so incredibly absurd? The only reason is because of the power of taking something you're saying as a major prophet, but not quite saying it, instead having it reaffirmed by the second tier. If the second tier can introduce the audience to this concept and say, we have this concept that God is giving this unusual blessing of seven letters in someone's name, well, the audience will then make the connection whenever the major prophet says what the minor prophet, or in this case, the fivefold minister, is saying, because it's an anointed saying by God. That's the thing to understand. The second tier are speaking things that are so absurd, yet at the same time, so anointed that the audience must be receptive to take it. In other words, the audience had to be trained to shut off all critical thinking, because nobody in their right mind is going to say that seven letters makes you more spiritual than Billy Graham. But that is exactly what happened, and it's all because of that second tier. It's very important to understand. A movement like this cannot survive unless you have that second tier of people who are echoing what the top tier is saying. And in fact, Bob Scott mentions this frequently, that there are people in the movement who do nothing but echo. And Bob's always asking, why is this? Why would you just echo? Why not go find out for yourself? Well, when you understand the hierarchy of these tiers, you begin to understand that it is an indoctrinated, trained experience. It's not something that people just naturally do. You naturally won't do this kind of thing. So the minor prophets are actually more important than the major prophets because they become the distributors of the major message. Without the middle tier, that top tier's message is not that important. But because of that second tier, these become the distributors of the major message. The weird problem that exists with this, if you go down the lineup of names of people who did not become the major prophets in the movement, there's some really weird and strange and unusual people. We've had many discussions on Bob Jones, and if you take the adultery, the predatorial things out of the picture and just look at the man and his message and his predictions and his prophecies and how weird all of that is, and you really would never just go follow Bob Jones of IHOPKC. There's no way that you would do it. But he was a distributor of Mike Bickle's message. He was the one in that middle tier who is making Mike Bickle's themes become established. Then once they're established, he doesn't matter anymore. He has already laid all the groundwork. So another way to say it, this middle tier of individuals, this is the connective tissue between what is the revivals and the local church. They're the ones who are taking the concept in these conventions, these auditoriums, back in the tent revivals from the tents. These are the people that would go to the local churches and help spread the message that we're affirming what our major prophet is saying. He's too busy to come see you, but we're going to affirm it. And what they're doing is they're laying the groundwork or the bridging between all of the apostolic networks that eventually form the New Apostolic Reformation. So if you're a person who is sympathetic to the New Apostolic Reformation or the charismatic movement in general, you're probably asking, okay, so John, what's so wrong with this? What does it mean if somebody is just simply backing somebody else and that the person that they're backing turns out to be wrong? We can't blame the people in the tier below because that's guilt by association. In fact, I get that challenge all the time. People will say, you can't do this, John, because this one person was preaching heresy or turned out to be a predator or whatever is the case. Because this other person is connected to them, you can't say that there's a problem here. All you can say is this is guilt by association, and John, that's wrong. But you have to understand that's not the way this works in this type of movement. There's a bigger problem here that really can't be overlooked. So, in my opinion, here are some examples of why this is wrong. You have this middle tier of people, some of whom claim to be a prophet. Yet at the same time, we don't have many of their prophecies. My examples were limited to what we have with Anna Schrader just because I have one of her books. But think of all of the others. We do have people like, what's a good example? Bill Britton. Steve Montgomery and I, when we talk about converging apostasy, will always go back to people like Bill Britton because we do have their works. Point is this. Other than just a select few, we don't even have their prophecies. So the biblical instruction for a prophet is to tell if it's a prophet by God, we need to evaluate and see, did the thing that they said before the event happen correctly as they stated? If not, this is not a prophecy from God. It's that pure, plain, and simple. But the problem is the movement has by and large forgotten this middle tier. There are a few handfuls, yes, I've looked at them. Some of them, like Sam Fife, I think he might be considered a middle tier prophet. Well, he spun off into his own movement, and so we do have some of his prophecies. That much is true. But how about Anna Schrader? Where are you going to go and find all of her many prophecies? I found one book on Amazon. I can't find them all. These people validated the major prophet. So if you're claiming the guilt by association card, it's more than just that, because they're the ones who are re-emphasizing and they're echoing what the major prophet says. They're making it suddenly feel like a move of God, and it's less like a lone, eccentric, heretic person. They're given credibility, I think is the best way to say it. And that's really, for me, that's one of the strongest arguments against this type of thing. And second, if you really go deep into what these prophecies are, because they're so very vague, I read through some of the Anna Schrader prophecies, and you can do it too. You can buy her book on Amazon cheaply. I did. You can go through those, and you see that they're very vague, and they're always in this format. They're going to use Bible names instead of the real names, which means I can apply this prophecy to anybody, and I can't really prove did it fail, because they'll just say, well, that's not the Elijah. That's not the Ahab and Jezebel I was talking about. It's this new person. And then when that one fails, it's the person after that. You can just go down the line because it's not specific. The other thing that I noticed as I'm reading through, there's always an out. They, yea, I say unto you, Ahab and Jezebel, this, that, and the other, unless this, that, and the other. And so how can you prove the prophecy failed? They'll just say, well, the unless part. You missed the unless part. And even though some of the details may be vague, some of them, even if they don't come to pass, there's no way to prove it. What they are instead doing, and this is the part that most people miss, they are the ones who are translating the message for the ordinary people. The major prophet gives the prophecy, gives the commission, gives the revelation, whatever it is. Well, it has to be broken down into bite-sized, understandable pieces. And this middle tier does this. Sometimes they do it through prophecy because you can reaffirm the prophecy while breaking it down into tiny bite-sized pieces, especially if you give biblical names that people can go, oh, I recognize the name Elijah. I recognize the name Ahab and Jezebel. Let's go read the Bible and see what it says. Wow, that sounds exactly like that person who's in politics right now. And that's really how it works. They're translating the message, sometimes not even by translating it, but by inferring what the message is by pointing people to names that are used in Scripture. The other thing that they do is that, and this is really problematic for me, I've had huge conversations with Jed about this, and Bob Scott. They keep the mythology alive between the major events. And the event might be a commission, the event might be a convention, the event might be a prophecy. Basically, this thing happens. It gets everybody up into the entertainment, the excitement, the euphoria. People are addicted to this high that they get with the leader. Well, whenever that stops, something has to keep the movement alive. And so as revivalists, during the Latter Rain Revival, they can't be everywhere. They'll go to a city, they'll hold a big convention, they'll pray for the sick, but then they'll go to the next city. They might go, maybe they're in Dallas this time, maybe they go to Los Angeles the next time. Well, what about all those people in Dallas? Now the euphoria is gone. The entertainment is gone. This emotional high that they get on is gone. How do you keep people in that state without them just saying, wait a minute, that didn't sit quite right. There's something quite wrong here. Well, the middle tier is what keeps everything alive. Now they've got more books they can read. They've got publications, pamphlets. The middle tier might record sermons. Today they might record a YouTube video. Facebook, social media. This is the tier that keeps the momentum. In other words, if this is a vehicle, the revivalist, the apostle or prophet, they're the engine, but you have to have the wheels to keep the thing moving, and that's what the middle tier does. The other thing, which this is kind of funny when I realized it, I don't know, unless you have a specific example, I'm always going back to what I had in Branhamism, but there were things that were just so absurd that we believed. To embarrass myself, I was 37 years old, believing that a man living in Indiana who claimed to have been born in Kentucky, who claimed to be a hillbilly, could speak a squirrel into existence for the sole purpose of shooting its head off with a shotgun. That was part of our mythology. That was Branhamism mythology. It's absurd. When I look back at this, had I just simply attended a meeting where he made this ridiculous claim, and I'm just sitting in the audience and I hear him make the claim for the first time and I go back home, never hear it again, eventually I'm going to say, well, that was pretty stupid. But if you have this middle tier Like my grandfather, who was in that middle tier, not as a prophet, but as a fivefold minister, they're the ones who soften the absurd by spreading these claims and talking about them gradually, by emphasizing them through relating passages of the Bible to what happened to the minister. They're the ones who numb the pain that you might otherwise get by hearing something that was just incredibly absurd. And out of all of the jobs that the middle tier has, I would say that is probably the biggest one. If you don't have that, if you don't have somebody to soften these weird claims, you can't really build a movement and make it stick. But because of them doing this, and I picture also using my grandfather as an example, his home church was in Jeffersonville, Indiana, once he took over pastorship of this church. But there were times that he would be called to other cities, or he might travel and just visit on vacation another city. And what happens is the people there, they want to hear more too. This person is a middle tier. We want to hear more about what he says. What do you think the prophet meant when he said X, Y, and Z? Well, my grandfather was one of the people who would explain what he thought the prophet meant. And then after he would leave that town, you would watch the ministers debate on whether or not his perspective was correct or if he was full of it. And interestingly, because I went from church to church, I have actually heard sermons about when he was full of it. So there's some weirdness out there, but they are the ones that bridge the movements and the network together because of this. The people who have itching ears want to hear more, and they can't directly access the central figure in many cases, so they go to that middle tier. And because of that middle tier, you can connect all of the dots that I have in my research. If not for that middle tier, I would have never known that International House of Prayer in Kansas City could be connected back to Branhamism or Latter Rain. I would have never known or guessed that Hobart Freeman in Indiana was connected to that same thing, and that many of his people went to IHOP KC after his cult imploded. I mean, there's so many spider webs of connections, and that's because that middle tier is bridging all of these movements together. In the computer world, they are the network cables that make your computer communicate with across the internet to the computer in the remote server, or the other individual who's sitting there typing you a chat message. They're that conduit, basically. The other thing that they do, and this is so sad when I think about it, they're the ones who made all of the abuse and the errors survive. People were abused emotionally, spiritually, sometimes physically or sexually. And what happened, because they're numbing the absurdity, at the same time, they're numbing the error. And for me, that's problematic. I look at my grandfather, and I loved my grandfather. I thought he was a good man. And I still, to some extent, believe he was. But he was caught up in this system where he was a key player in that middle tier, making the problems survive. And for me, that's a problem. That's something that needs to be corrected. When you're in a group that bad things can continue, they will, and you'll find people who will abuse that system. We see time after time these new leaders come and they rise up and some scandal breaks out and it hits the news. People always look to the point of conduct, the code of conduct that was happening with the leader himself, because that's the star, that's the Moses prophet for the age or whatever. But they never go back that one level. If you go back that one level, you'll find why that was enabled, how they got platformed, what they did to platform themselves. An example of this is Todd Bentley. There's many things that you can read on the internet about him. You can watch some videos, things that are pretty bad if they're true. Well, whenever people see the bad, they want to connect him to other people in the top tier. So they'll watch a video and they'll say, oh, he was platformed by Bill Johnson or Mike Bickle or whoever it was. They'll say, these people are on stage together with these other people and they're supporting each other and therefore they can survive. But that's technically not true. The people who are at the top tier survive because of the tier under them. You have people who are enabling that to continue. And the problem is, everyone in that tier knows how the system works. So if you are in one corner and you are an NAR prophet and you're doing these things that are heretical or outright evil, and you have a lower tier that's supporting you and numbing it down for the people, you're already aware that the other guy on the other side of the country is doing the same thing. So when you get on stage with them, the funny part is some of these people know how bad the other person is, but they can't say anything because they know that tier underneath is the one who is enabling the whole thing. And if you expose that tier underneath, you've exposed yourself. That is a problem for me. You're victims of the system. There may be people, and there may be people I've mentioned on the podcast, who are actually good people who are in leadership positions over movements that are very destructive. They don't even realize that they're destructive, but they bought into the system where they're in this upper tier. I know good people who got into the fivefold ministry. They did some things that harmed other people. And they're not the faces that I can put to this are not bad people. They just got caught up in this bad system. So for me, correcting the system is the greatest importance. If we could do anything to correct what we see today, we need to examine the system and how it works. This middle tier is part of that system. So to sum all of this up, the danger was never just the famous man who's on the platform. The greater danger actually was this network of smaller voices that made him believable and portable, untouchable, presentable. Without that middle tier, these people would have just, their ministries would have failed. There wasn't really enough substance for them to continue. And some of the things that they claimed were just so absurd, people would never have believed them. I look at some of the, and every group has this kind of thing, but when you're in one of these destructive groups, you think that your group was the greatest thing ever. You had the special divine mysteries that nobody else had. And when you come in contact with another group who had the same view for their perspective, you think, well, my gosh, how could they believe something so crazy? And I did this while I was in Branhamism. When I came out of Branhamism, I suddenly realized my crazy wasn't any different than their crazy, and the other group's crazy wasn't any different than their crazy or my crazy. We're all the same crazy. We need to walk away from this. That's the absurdity that exists. And people don't just join into the absurd without some sort of a strategy behind getting them in it. That's what the middle tier does for me. So the point I'm trying to drive at here is everybody remembers the major prophets, the faces of the movement that have the big names, the ones that write the books, and you can go buy the books, and their ministries have a mythology behind it. But the real engine underneath that is that second tier, and that engine is the most important part of this whole thing. They made the unbelievable believable. They made the abuse sustainable, and they made the absolute absurd sound real. Without that middle tier, none of that really exists. So if you want to understand how these movements keep producing similar movements or reproducing themselves, you have to stop watching just that man on the stage. You have to watch, okay, here's a guy on the stage. Who are the voices who are supporting him? Maybe they're in another movement. Maybe they're helping him develop a movement. Maybe they're just common voices planted in the crowd who says, I believe you. Without that second tier, no matter how that tier is structured, the voice on the stage is limited. And so you'll never build a movement by one single voice. That movement has to be built by the echo. So Hopefully I've said something that makes sense. I've kind of went all over the place. There's so much to unpack here, and we don't really, from a research standpoint, we don't have a lot of the minor prophets and minor voices works. I actually tried to do a study on Anna Schrader. I was going to present a lot of things. I do have the Book of Prophecies, but just going through Voice of Healing, there's only one article that has her name on it that I could find. And there's just not a lot out there. Yet she is the one, whenever people say, well, Branham went astray, she's actually the one that they're referring to as the second tier, who is convincing the overall movement that, yes, Branham went astray. That's really what they're talking about here. So much to unpack. Hopefully I've made sense, and there's much more to tell for another day. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.